Our Bible reading tonight is Philippians chapter 2 and verses 12 to 18. We'll bring our Philippians series tonight to an end for this year, and then hopefully at some point in the new year we'll pick up from chapter 2 verse 19. But tonight, Philippians chapter 2 and verses 12 to 18. Let us hear the word of the Lord. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. Augustine said, if you ask me what are the ways of God, I will tell you that the first is humility, the second is humility, and the third is humility. Not that there are no other precepts to give, said Augustine, but if humility does not precede all that we do, our efforts are meaningless. Now, by that little phrase, the ways of God, Augustine was referring to God's ways for our life. He was saying that the preeminent thing about the Christian life is humility, humility, humility. And last week, we saw the most excellent example of humility, didn't we? Jesus Christ himself. He emptied himself and humbled himself. He made himself nothing. He hung like a slave with no rights on a bloodied cross. He sought the interests of others above his own. He lowered himself to the lowest class and served us on a cross. Humility, humility, humility. Now you may be wondering, okay, yes, Johnny, we remember last week's sermon, but there's no mention of humility here in chapter 2, verses 12 to 18. So why are you going on about a topic or a theme that was, well, so last week? Paul seems to have moved on to something new, doesn't he? Verse 12, work out your salvation. Verse 14, do everything without grumbling or disputing. Verse 15, shining like stars in the world. That sounds more like witness and evangelism. Do everything without grumbling and disputing sounds rather unrelated to humility. Work out your own salvation sounds very theological, not really experiential. Holding fast to the word of truth. Verse 16, that sounds more like determination rather than humiliation. And in chapter 2, verse 19 to 30, we'll see in the new year, it's a travel log. It's Paul's details of him coming to visit the church in Philippi, Epaphroditus coming, and Timothy coming after him. So why commence a sermon with a quote from Augustine, humility, 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 on a passage that doesn't mention humility? Well, because this passage is all about, you guessed it, humility. Let's just remind ourselves of the track that Paul has set us on last week. The catch-all verse for Philippians is not chapter 1, verse 21, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. The catch-all verse for Philippians is chapter 1, verse 27. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you, that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. What's Philippians all about? It's about two things: living in a manner worthy of the gospel, standing firm together for the gospel. Living in a manner worthy of the gospel, standing firm together for the gospel. What is the manner of the gospel? Humility. What is standing firm together? Church unity. Humility and church unity, that is what Philippians is all about. But it's not just two things as if they are unrelated. Did you notice the connection there in chapter 1, verse 27? There's a purpose clause. Paul's logic is, live in a manner worthy of the gospel so that you stand firm together for the gospel. That's Philippians in a nutshell. Live in a manner worthy of the gospel so that you stand firm together for the gospel. And last week, we saw how Paul urged us to strive for church unity through humility by conforming to Christ's humility. Strive for church unity through humility by conforming to Christ's humility. That was the train that Paul put us on in chapter 1, verse 27. And he kept us on that train to chapter 2, verse 11. So the question is, do we get off the train, the humility train, in chapter 2, verse 12, and get on a new train? Does Paul change topic here? Well, notice how verse 12 begins. Therefore, it's a conjunction of inference, of consequence. Therefore, in the light of Christ's humility, work out your own salvation. Do you see how verses 12 to 18, it's not a new topic, it's not a new train. We're still on the humility train. And what Paul is doing now is he is applying it to our lives. Notice also the repetition of the word obey in verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed. Just glance back to verse 8. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. And here is Paul, having explained the obedience of Christ in humility, now calls us to obey. In what? In humility. Just like Augustine, Paul is saying to us, this passage is about humility, humility, humility. It's just that he explains it using different words and in a different way. He gives us three exhortations, and each of them relate to this topic of humility. The first exhortation is general, and the second two are specific. Let's deal with the general one first. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Verses 12 and 13. Therefore, in light of Christ's humility, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Now, I remember when I heard those verses years ago, thinking that this was an encouragement for me as a young Christian man to delve into books on the doctrine of salvation and reform theology. I thought work out your own salvation meant work out God's saving work in Christ. Work out your view of election and predestination with fear and trembling. Work out your view on the intent and nature of the atonement. Is it limited or unlimited? And do it with fear and trembling. Work out whether the Spirit can irresistibly draw someone to themselves or whether someone can resist the Spirit, and do it with fear and trembling. Work out your view on the end times. That's how I used to think about this verse. And while those things are important and while they're not unrelated to this, Paul is primarily speaking here in practical and in experiential terms. He's speaking about the outworking of the gospel in our day-to-day lives. Again, it's the therefore that shows us that. Paul has been exhorting us to do what? Chapter 2, verse 4, to be humble, to let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. And verse 3, in humility to count others more significant than ourselves. And then he gives us the example of Christ and his humility. And Paul says, now, in the light of that, in the light of Christ's humility, work out what this looks like in your own life. Work out how to be humble. Work out your own salvation. Work out what it looks like to live in a manner worthy of the gospel. God has saved you. Now go and work out what saving grace in your life looks like. In particular, work out what death on a cross looks like for you. He's still on the same theme. He's just using different words. Last night we had the CPC book club in our home, and we were looking at the book by Rosaria Butterfield. Hands up if you know the book, Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. Half of you. It's a book by a Christian lady, a minister's wife, who lived a lesbian lifestyle. She was a university lecturer writing in feminist studies and in the religious right, and she becomes a Christian. And one of the things that we discussed last night in the book club was that when she became a Christian, one of the things she spent most time asking other Christians in the church was, what does repentance look like? What does obedience look like? What does a godly life look like? This was a girl who was unchurched, who had no religious background apart from being baptized in the Catholic Church as a baby. She didn't have a clue. She'd been saved, but she was needing help. What it looked like to be godly, to be obedient. What was she doing when she walked around church asking these Christians? She was saying, can you help me work out my own salvation? That is what this is about. And interestingly, in the book, she says that the root cause of homosexuality is not the problem of sexual orientation. The root cause is pride. That is what she pinpoints as the issue with homosexuality. And she was trying to work out, what does it look like now to be humble? Having lived a proud lifestyle, what does it look like to be humble? So work out your salvation is a catch-all phrase for working out the implications of the gospel in our lives, walking in a manner worthy of the gospel. And what is the manner that is worthy of the gospel? Humility. Because it is the gospel about the Christ who humbled himself. And Paul says there, you'll notice in verse 12, we are to do this with fear and trembling. Now those two words are used in the Old Testament to describe the nations outside of Israel trembling and fearing God's presence with his people. Exodus 15 and Psalm chapter 2. People are to fear and tremble in the presence of God. It's not a slavish terror, but it's a holy reverence in God's presence. Now, you've heard Ian use the phrase a number of times, coram Deo, the little Latin pithy phrase. It means before the face of God. And I think that little phrase, before the face of God, helpfully captures the sense here. We are to live out our lives, work out the implications of the gospel in our lives, before the face of God. In other words, with awe and reverence in his presence. Let me return to the book club that we had last night. It was a good occasion. Everyone was well-mannered. People were courteous to each other. People brought food. People served food. The conversation was pleasant. Everyone was behaving well last night. we were all conducting ourselves well. Why? Because we were in the presence of others. We were guests last night with one another. Now, sadly, we're not always so well behaved in the presence of those with whom we are most familiar, i.e. our family. Isn't it when we have guests come into our home, we sort of up the standard of conduct? Well, we do it subconsciously, consciously sometimes. We just up our level of conduct. Now imagine next book club, the Queen comes for a visit to the book club. How would we all conduct ourselves? Exactly the same way as last night? I pretty much imagine we'd all up our game even more. We'd think about how we speak. We'd think about how we act. We'd conduct ourselves in a way that reflected that we are in the presence of royalty, of Her Majesty. And that's Paul's point here. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Why? Because you do it in the presence of royalty, of His Majesty. Work out how to live in a manner worthy of the gospel in the presence of Almighty God. Work out how to be humble in the presence of the One before whom all pride and pretense vanishes. Well, the working out, you can see in verse 12, is all ours. It's a command to us. But the good news is that we're not left to ourselves, verse 13. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Now, Paul might be absent as they work out their salvation, but God is not. That's why we are to do it in fear and trembling. Why? Because God is in us, working out His will for us. Now, this God working in us, this is not synergism. You know, at work or at university where you get split up into workshops and you have an overall task that you need to do, and this person gets assigned to this part and this person gets assigned to that part. And each of you do your part, and then you come back together and you complete the whole thing together. You're working synergistically together. Or for some of the young people, it's a bit like a three-legged race. You know, two people, you tie the legs together and you both run together in unison. That is not what this is like. Sanctification, which is the technical word for this aspect of working out your own salvation, it's not a synergism. There is a mystery here. Sanctification is all our work, all of it, and it is all God's work. And we must leave the mystery with Him. In sanctification, we are the ones who are to work out the implications of the gospel in our lives. But we are to do it knowing that it is God who works in us to help us will and work for His good pleasure. And that's the key phrase there, to will and to work for His good pleasure. That's not related to God working. That's actually related to us working. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to help you to will and to work for His good pleasure. In other words, God energizes our will and our activity in order that we might bring Him pleasure by completing our salvation. The work is all ours, but it's also all God's. And that is a really important distinction, that it's all our work, but it's all God's. But it's a really important qualifier, because in the end, we have nothing to boast about. Any work that we do in our salvation, in sanctification, in applying the gospel to our lives, is God-given. Any humility that we ever achieve is a God-given humility. Any service of others that we ever do is a God-given service of others. Any progress in sanctification is a God-given process. Calvin puts it well when he says, perseverance is His pure gift. We are to persevere. We are to work out our salvation. But all of it is His pure gift to help us to work and to will for His good pleasure. So that's the first implication of Paul's presentation of Christ's humility. Work out your own salvation. Work out how to be humble. Work out how to live in a manner worthy of the gospel. Number two, do everything without grumbling and arguing. Do everything without grumbling and arguing. Verses 14 to 16. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Now you'll notice at the beginning of verse 14, in most of your Bibles, it starts a new paragraph. There's no connecting word like therefore or however or but. However, I think that verse 14 is a more specific example of working out your own salvation. I don't think this is a brand new topic again. I think he's now just becoming really specific and giving an example of what it means to work out your own salvation. It's quite general. Do everything, do all things, but it's also very specific, isn't it? Without grumbling and questioning. So the question is, does Paul mean everything? Does all things mean all things? And what does Paul mean by do not grumble and dispute or question or argue? Is Paul saying that we are never to dispute anything in everything we do? Well, he can't mean that, because if we had time, we could go to Acts chapter 16, where he gets arrested in Philippi. And what does he do when he gets arrested? Well, he argues about why he's got arrested. Okay, so it's not like he's sort of learnt a lesson and thought, well, I shouldn't have argued there. And often in Acts, when Paul gets arrested, what does he do? He disputes it. He says, hey, I'm a Roman citizen. What are you doing arresting me? So he can't be meaning in every situation, no matter what, you never open your mouth and question anything or dispute anything. There must be a context to what Paul is saying here and what he means. I think there are three contextual factors that help us understand this command. The first is in the immediate context. I go back to the humility train that we're on. Remember chapter 1, verse 27? Paul's put us on the humility train and we're heading for destination church unity. That's the context here that we must understand these words. Standing together for the gospel. Church unity is one of the themes and threads that runs throughout this book. Just come back with me to chapter 1, because I want you to feel the emphasis here. Chapter 1, verse 1. I want you to notice the word all the way through chapter 1. Verse 1, to all the saints. Verse 4, he remembers always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy. Verse 7, it is right for me to feel this way about you all. Verse 8, for God is my witness, how I yearn for you all. And then verse 25, convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all. Verse 27, that you stand together as one man in one spirit, side by side. There's the unity theme again. And then in chapter 4, verse 2, he entreats Euodia and Syntyche to agree in the Lord. Yes, and you also, my true companion, help these women who have labored. Note the phrase, similar to chapter 1. Side by side with me in the gospel together, with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers. Do you hear the unity theme coming out there? It's all about unity, church unity. So not grumbling or arguing is connected to the internal relations within the church. It's a bit like a family having dinner at the dinner table. We were at the Bryans today for Sunday lunch. And I'm pleased to report there was no arguing and no grumbling, except over who was going to get the last slice of lemon meringue. But it was a pleasant time. We all got on very well. And it was a great occasion. Now, what happens at home when you're at the dinner table and someone grumbles about the food? Kids, what happens? Is it a nice time around the dinner table? No. What happens when there's an argument breaks out over who's going to get the last slice of something? Is it a peaceful time? No. Grumbling and arguing at the dinner table, what does it cause? Disharmony, disunity. So that's the first context. He's speaking about the context of the church community. Do nothing in the church community with grumbling or arguing, disputing. There's a second contextual factor, and that is the Old Testament context here. I wonder if, as we read those words, the phrase grumbling and disputing or grumbling and arguing reminded you of anything. It's Israel in the desert, isn't it, with Moses, grumbling and disputing with Moses. And the phrase in verse 15, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, that is a direct allusion to Deuteronomy 32, verse 5. Let me read it. They, Israel, have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer God's children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and a twisted generation. Paul in Philippians is quoting Deuteronomy 32, verse 5. What is he doing? He's trying to say to the Philippian church, don't be like Israel in the desert who grumbled and argued with their leader, Moses. So I think what's going on here is that Paul borrows that language of the Old Testament because he's trying to say, don't grumble and argue against your church leaders like there was with Israel against Moses. Now, you may say, well, reading into that, well, look at chapter 1, verse 1. He writes this letter to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are at Philippi, including the overseers and deacons. Now, Paul, in all of his letters, never refers to the elders and deacons in his opening address, only in Philippians. He just always says to all the saints in Rome, etc. So I think here there's some kind of dispute going on, perhaps between the laity and the leadership. And Paul has this in mind as well. Do everything in the church community without grumbling or disputing with your leaders. And then there's a third context, and that is the church is in the world, being watched by the world. Come back with me to chapter 1, verse 27, and then at 28 he says, stand side by side for the faith of the gospel and not frightened in anything by your opponents. So the church is the church not in a vacuum, but in the world being opposed. And he says in verse 29, it's been granted to you to suffer at the hands of these opponents. And then look at verse 15. We are to be blameless, innocent, children of God without blemish. Where? In the midst, not in a ghetto, not in a Christian ghetto, but in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. The dinner table has now moved outside into the back garden in the summer with the neighbors looking on. They're now listening to hear if there's any grumbling, if there's any disputing going on. Do you get the picture? It's the church community, it's the church with its leaders, and now it's the church in the world. And Paul says, as a church, do nothing with grumbling or complaining. Do everything without those things. So that, verse 15, we might be blameless, innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. And then he has this beautiful line, among whom you shine as lights in the world. What a beautiful picture of Christians and the Christian church. As the church stands firm together, united with its leaders, holding fast to the word of life in opposition to the world, what are we? We are stars in the night sky. Israel was called to be a light to the nations, Isaiah 42. And the picture here is picked up by Paul. And the concept of light complements the description of us if we do everything without grumbling or questioning. Verse 15, blameless, innocent, without blemish. Now, light can do two things. Early in the morning, you're fast asleep in bed, and someone puts the light on. Are you attracted by the light? No. You're repulsed by it. You were enjoying your sleep in the dark. But when you're looking for something in the house, and it's dark, and someone sticks the light on, are you attracted by it? Do you like it? Of course. It brings light into the room. Now the question is Paul meaning that we are lights in the world that are repulsive, that people, they're blinding lights, people don't want to look at us? Or is it lights in the world like stars in the sky? Who do you know is ever repulsed by a beautiful starry night? Nobody. And that is the picture that Paul has here. Lights in the world. It is not a repulsive light. It is an attractional light. And do you see how earthy and practical Paul is? Paul says, do you want to be an attractive Christian? Do you want to be an attractive church? Then do everything without grumbling, without disputing. It's incredibly earthy, isn't it? If you go to work this week or school or university and you do everything without complaining or grumbling, you will stand out. Not like a sore thumb. You will stand out like a star in the night sky. What are people going to say tomorrow morning? They're going to grumble about what? Traffic, weather, homework, university paper. People grumble all the time. We grumble, 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 grumble. And Paul says, don't be a grumbler. And I remember it when I worked as a physio, Monday mornings was all about having a good gripe or a good grumble about having to be back at work, having to be back in class. And Paul says, you have the opportunity to shine like a star. And Paul himself is a wonderful example, isn't he? Where is he writing this? From prison, chapter 1, verse 14. He has more than enough reason for a good old grumble. There's a group in Rome doing Christian ministry out of envy and rivalry, chapter 1, verse 15 to 17, to spite Paul, to add to his troubles. He has a very good reason to start an argument. His life, chapter 2, verse 17, is being poured out like a drink offering for the Philippians' faith, another reason to grumble. He's suffering for the gospel, such that he has very little, so that they have to send Epaphroditus to him to meet his needs. He's got another reason to grumble. He doesn't have much in Rome. Epaphroditus has fallen ill in chapter 2, verse 25. He has to send him back, so he's got another reason to gripe and to grumble. But what does Paul do? Doesn't grumble. Verse 17, he rejoices. We'll come to that in a minute. But what would have happened had he grumbled? What would the prison guards have heard? Are you on shift tonight with that grumbler? Are you on shift tonight with a guy who keeps disputing about the food in here? He shone like a star in the prison. If he had grumbled, there would have been disharmony in the church, as he argued with the people who were doing stuff out of rivalry. His light would have started to fade. But I want to pause here and try and unpack a bit more about why grumbling and disputing are wrong. Recently, Ian's been using a very nice phrase where he says, all psychology is theology and all theology is psychology. I was waiting for him to tell me it's from John Calvin or something, but I don't think Calvin would have known about psychology as such then. It's a great wee phrase. All psychology is theology and all theology is psychology. So the question is, what is the theology of the psychology of our grumbling and disputing? Let's just think about the first bit there of grumbling and disputing. It's an expression of unthankfulness to God and pride in our hearts. Grumbling and disputing is an expression of unthankfulness to God and pride in our hearts. Let me deal with the first bit. Unthankfulness to God. When we grumble about our circumstances, we're grumbling against the God who has ordained our circumstances. It's like the weather. Did you grumble about the weather today? Raining all the time. If we grumble about the weather, then we're grumbling against the God who sent us the weather, whatever the weather. And it's the same with other Christians or our church leaders or opposition from people in the world. If we grumble about those things, if we dispute them, what are we doing? We're grumbling and disputing against the God who ordained for those people to be in our lives. We're grumbling and disputing against the God who has ordained, verse 27, 29 of chapter 1, who has granted it to us to suffer for the sake of Christ. So if we grumble, even in our suffering for the gospel, we are grumbling against God. We are unthankful. Then there's that second aspect. Grumbling and disputing is a sign of pride in our hearts. When you're in a traffic jam and you need to be somewhere on time, you're meeting somewhere, and you start complaining and arguing and grumbling about the traffic, whose interests do you have at heart? I know when I'm in a traffic jam and I want to get somewhere again, whose interests do I have at heart? Not someone else's, my own. This is my road. That's my meeting that I need to get to. This is my time. It's my face that I need to save for not being late. What's happening in the traffic jam? I'm saying Johnny's prayer, not the Lord's prayer. I'm saying my kingdom come, my will be done. And how dare these people be on the road at this time? It's my world, it's my kingdom, it's my will. And that is the root cause of grumbling and complaining. It is selfish self-interest. It is pride. Grumblers and complainers are proud people because they think the world revolves around them. And Paul exhorts us to not be grumblers or complainers, because when we do that, self is on the throne. Rather, we are called to be humble, to put self on the cross, Christ on the throne, and to put other people's interests above our own. It's a bit like when you have an argument with someone, church disagreements and arguments and sadly splits, in my experience, are usually because both sides refuse to be beaten. I remember hearing Don Carson say that he's lost many arguments with his wife, but he's never lost a rerun in his head. Why does he not lose the rerun? Because of pride. Pride says that we don't want to lose. We don't want to lose the argument. We don't want to lose the dispute. Well, what does Paul do instead of grumbling and complaining? He humbles himself. He puts the interests of others. He lets the rival group win, who are preaching the gospel out of ill motives. He lets them win. And in verse 17, he offers himself, his life, as a drink offering. He puts the interests of the Philippians' faith above his own. What did Jesus Christ do? He had every reason to grumble and complain. What did he do? He emptied himself of all his rights, all the rights to win the arguments against the Jews, against Herod, against Pilate, against the mockers, against the thieves. He let them win. He served others. He became obedient to death on a cross. He said, "Father, not my will be done, but yours." He didn't grumble. He didn't complain. He went as a sheep before its shearers is silent. Humility, humility, humility. Paul is saying to us here in this passage, we're still on the humility train. But that's not where Paul ends this paragraph. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Do everything without grumbling and disputing. And third, be glad and rejoice always. Do you see how he finishes it, verse 18? I am glad and rejoice, verse 17. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. And then you see it again in chapter 4, verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Do you see the context it comes in verse 4 of chapter 4? The dispute between Euodia and Syntyche. That's not just a random thing about rejoice. That is penetrating into this context of disharmony and division. Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan from America, said that the answer to killing sin was not just killing sin, but replacing it with the power of a new affection. Grumbling and disputing is a sin in our lives. We must kill it. It's an expression of unthankfulness to God, of pride in our hearts, but it needs to be replaced by something. You can't just kill sin. You need to replace the desire for sin with a desire for something else, the power of a new affection. And what is that new affection? Paul says, joy, gladness. Do you see it there? You should also be glad and rejoice with me. But for the joy set before him, the joy our Lord endured the cross. What's the antidote to grumbling and complaining? I wish we had more time to unpack this. Romans 1, you can look it up. Ephesians 5, thankfulness, joy, rejoicing, thankfulness is the antidote to impure speech. Ephesians 5, Paul does not say, don't speak things that are coarse and impure. Speak things that are clean. He doesn't say that. He says, don't speak things that are impure, but rather give thanks. Thankfulness, joy, rejoicing is the antidote to our speech when it's gone askew. So be a rejoicer, not a complainer, and you will shine like the stars in the night sky. You will shine like Christ did in his humility on a cross.